Hi there, I'm Paul Straw, and you're listening to Does Not Compute on the Spec Network. Spec has lots of amazing shows, and you should make sure to check the rest of them out. We just launched a new one called Orthogonal. It's hosted by Brett Kelly and Andrew Carroll, who you might already know from his guest appearance on Immutable. They're going to be talking about all sorts of great stuff, specifically around the topics of freelancing and finances. Andrew and Brett are both really sharp guys, and I'm personally looking forward to learning a lot from them. Of course, we'll have a link to their show page in today's show notes, but you can also learn more by heading over to spec.fm.
Last week was a long week. A rough week for me.
Yeah, it was kind of a strange one for me as well. I was a little sick, and it was just odd with the workload I had on.
Yeah, I had just been in JavaScript mode again for a while, and then our backend dev had 2 weeks off, and so I had to do a lot of Ruby work, which just was another like context shift. So it took me a while to get back into the swing of things, and then I also had a couple of issues that I needed to debug that weren't like an afternoon of debugging and then fixing a problem. It was more of like a 2 day, 3 day setup in fixing these problems.
That's always tough, especially when you have multiple different responsibilities, like I know you do, where you have something that requires a lot of attention. It requires that you sit down at a computer for 4 hours straight or something like that and just focus on it. And that's not always easy to do in a professional context.
Yeah, and this one was like an onion too, so I would peel back a layer and think to myself, I got it, and then realize that there's just another layer beneath, and I'd peel that one back too and figure that out. So it was kind of like a roller coaster of like, yeah, I think I got it to work, and then, oh, not quite. There's another thing that needs attention.
Yep. There's just more onion underneath, and you're already crying.
That's a pretty accurate analogy, actually. But I learned a lot of myself this past 2 weeks. I learned a lot about when you're trying to solve a problem and you have to think about the same thing for a long period of time. Well, first of all, I learned how I'm not very good at that still. It's something I need to practice. And I also learned that I have a very specific way of understanding how problems work. And there's one thing that I can do that makes it really easy for me to actually be able to understand a problem, because I'm really good at hitting something from a bunch of different angles, but never really connecting the dots, if that makes sense.
Could you go into a bit more detail on that? I'm not sure I totally follow.
Yeah. So for example, let's say you're trying to fix a bug and you have an idea and you think to yourself, let's try this, see if that works. And that might not work. So then I would have another idea and try that, and that might not work, and third try, that might not work. But what I wasn't doing in between that was connecting the dots in between, like, why did try one not work, and why did try two not work, and are those correlated at all? And if one and two don't work, why doesn't three work, and are those correlated at all?
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. So a lot of times when you're debugging something, you will try a lot of solutions, and if you just look at each solution that you try on its own, it's really hard to get anywhere. Even when something fails, even when something you try fails, there's something there to learn. There's always, oh, this didn't work in this way because of something else in the code base or something like that. I mean, that's a contrived example, but there's always something to learn even from failed tests when you're debugging.
Right. And it makes it especially difficult if a bug is happening and there's multiple contributing factors to that. There's not one thing that's throwing it off. Like I said, it was kind of a layered thing that was happening. And I tend to try to move too quickly. Again, that stupid post-it note I keep talking about, it's really bent now, so I can barely see the don't try to be too fast note. If you try to move too quickly, it's easy to get tunnel vision on the specific, like say the specific holes that you're drilling in this problem. So you can't actually step back and see the complete picture of how you're attacking it and where and why your attempts haven't been working. But what I did do was, and I think I actually was rubber ducking with you one morning. I asked you to take a look over something that I had written, and I was trying to approach it in a more scientific or thoughtful manner. And so what I did was I opened up a Dropbox paper, just created a new document, and I typed out the word hypothesis, and I just wrote down all of my thoughts. What could possibly be going wrong to cause this to happen? And after I got like three or four, that had just sparked me to check out a few other things. And that's actually what led me to being able to figure out what was going on.
The more projects I work on, the more I realize that writing stuff down is such a huge part of programming. And I don't mean writing code down. I mean taking notes and really sitting down and kind of reflecting on what you know about a problem and how you might try to solve it. And this can be at the beginning of a project. This can be during the planning phases. Writing stuff out is something I never used to do. When I was originally starting a program, I would just jump in. But these days, the very first thing I do after I set up a new repo is I touch readme.md and then start writing in it. I write out the goals of the project. There needs to be a paragraph at the top that describes what I'm trying to do here. And then I write out how I think the API might work. I write out all those things. And so that's, writing is such a universal thing, I feel like, in programming. Something that sticks with you from the very beginning of a project all the way through debugging it once it's in production.
Yeah, totally. It's a very important skill, especially when you're working with other developers. And in your case, when you're working on a lot of open source projects, being able to communicate clearly and communicate the plan and what's coming forward, the roadmap, items to do, et cetera, even, you know, how they can clone the repo down and get the test running or the project set up. It's super important. And the interesting thing is when I took a step back, I realized that I was approaching bugs in a fix as soon as possible so I can get to other features, as opposed to a, this is a real problem, it needs to be solved, it needs to be solved right, so it warrants spending more time on it. And so what I ended up doing was shifting my mindset to, instead of, you know, pushing for, hey, this is fixed, you know, in the quickest way possible, pushing more for, I have a document that outlined what happened and what went wrong and how I fixed it. And so when I do that, I now have this outline essentially that I can use to either write tests, I can use to write documentation around it, I can use, even going forward down the road, if I keep this thing around, I can, if I run into a similar problem down the road, I can just do a search in my paper folder and I might come across that solution again, right? And it's kind of a similar idea as to what we've been doing with the playbook and documenting bugs that we find or gotchas that we find, except for this, I guess, is more on a personal level. But it was really helpful for me to actually frame the problem and just throw any guesses out. So I remember specifically you saying, well, this one seems a little bit far-fetched. And I knew it was kind of a long shot, but I put it there anyway just to have as many hypotheses as possible. And then once I had those hypotheses written down, what I started doing was making checkboxes. Try this, try that, do this, do that. And I just made a list of to-do items and I just moved down the list and started checking them off one by one. And sure enough, the problem surfaced and I fixed it.
The other nice thing about having a list of things that you want to try written out is that kind of provides you with a really nice base level structure for writing about your findings from each test. So you can have a checklist, that's fine. But then underneath that, if this is something that's helpful for people, what they can do really easily is just add after they do that test, oh, here's what I learned. So it wasn't caused by this thing, but a separate item may be interfering here. And then you have this nice history, because when you're debugging, it's so, so easy to even kind of forget what you've already tried or in which ways you've already tried something. So I like kind of the structure that lends.
Right. And it also allows you to isolate things as well. So as you're writing your document out and writing up your hypotheses, you can isolate things really well. You can separate them. You know, you can, like what I started doing was leaving lots of spaces in between hypotheses and possible solutions. So that way, as I'm looking at it, I'm really focused on that. But the other information around it is just really accessible. And I don't know why it just works for me, but it just clicked when I started doing that. And then so the other thing I started doing was I started making a new document. And this kind of goes back to the to-do app talk that we had a while back and how I said nothing really sticks, except to maybe a piece of paper and a pencil. But this has been working really well for me is I just have a document labeled today and I'll just clear it out every morning and I'll just make a list of things that I know I have to do. And I don't know why it works so well for me with paper. I tried it with Canvas as well and it worked just fine. But to me, a lot of other people on my team use paper, so I just keep using that. I don't know what it is, man. It's like, I can go to my phone, it's there, it's real time. I can go to my computer, it's there, it's real time. I can go to it on someone else's computer and it's there and it's real time. But the fact that it doesn't force me into like a structured to-do system and the fact that I can just basically dump information as I think it's useful is really helpful to me.
So Sean, earlier before this episode, you mentioned that you wanted to talk to me about your life hack. But you wouldn't tell me what your life hack is. So I got to know.
So I just mentioned my life hack, actually. It's a Dropbox paper document that says today up top. And it's just a list of things that I quickly dump in the morning, just dump in there. And I've been doing it for about a week now. And on Friday, I think it was, I had 19 items that I wrote down. And no, 23 items that I wrote down. And I closed off 19 of those within that day. that was one of the first days in a long time. And like I mentioned, that our backend dev has been gone, so I've been doing a lot more work that is stretching for me. And so it was the first day in a couple of weeks that I felt like I really was productive that day. And basically it was because I kept this tab pinned. And when I was done doing something, I just went back to the tab and looked at what was next and just moved through the list, essentially.
I like that you tricked me by just slipping it right in there. You didn't even say it was your life hack. It's your one weird trick, Sean.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a couple of different things, right? I linked you to an article earlier that was titled The End of Reflection. It's written by the New York Times, and we can put in the show notes. But granted, a lot of that article was pretty just generalized stuff. But just reading the title itself kind of pushed me to think about something that I've been trying to do lately. And that is I'm trying to foster longer periods of thought about one subject. So I keep mentioning that I'm really good at bouncing around different subjects and keeping my attention on things for brief periods of time. And I know that's something that I need to work on as a programmer, as someone that has to communicate things to other team members and clients. And it's just a really important skill set. So what I've been doing is I've been keeping my phone plugged in across the room and keeping my Apple Watch plugged in across the room. And I have a Kindle next to my bed and I try to read from the same book every night. And what I'm finding is that this is helping me be more able to focus on a single subject for longer periods of time. And that was really useful for me when I was debugging the same problem for a couple of days. It's been helping me not get as distracted as easily. And I read this book maybe a couple of years ago. I'll have to look up the title, but it talks about how willpower and habit is essentially a muscle and you have to exercise and use this muscle. And if you don't, then it gets weaker, meaning that you have less focus and less willpower. And so I'm actually treating it like almost like going to the gym. So at night I'll read. Recently it's been a PHP book of all books because I've been having to do some PHP work as well. But you know, it's been really useful for me to go back to the same material and think about what I read the night before and think about what I just read. You know, I guess having more periods of reflection. So reading through a book, reading through this PHP book, and then reflecting upon it without any music, without a TV on in the background, without any external source of stimulation, just me and myself and my thoughts.
Yeah, I've been doing something kind of similar to that. I actually have on all my computers and my phone now notifications completely disabled. So on the Mac, that translates to having do not disturb mode turned on from 12 a.m. to 11:59 p.m. And effectively, I just never see the little bubbles pop up in the corner of my screen. When I realize that it's time for me to check email, whether that's because I have it scheduled or because I just check it every, you know, once in a while, I go and check email. When it's time for me to check Slack, I go and check Slack. And of course, if something is urgent, I will still get notifications for it. Like things will come through in various ways. But for the vast majority of conversation that just doesn't need to happen right now, I've found that it allows me to have so much more focus on stuff that I actually need to get done. Because there are an infinite number of distractions out there, right? Every single day, you go into an office, or if you work remote, you are in a virtual office, you're in Slack or HipChat or whatever, you are there. And if you want, it would be possible. It would be very possible, I think, to have a job and never accomplish anything directly related to your job. Just help team members out, just have conversations about other things in the company without ever doing your role. So easy for that to happen. And I think that happens to some degree to a lot of people every single day.
It definitely does. I think it was a tweet that I saw, but again, I'll try and find this and put it in the show notes, but someone essentially was saying that by having Slack, your boss is basically saying, talk to your friends all day, and like, we're not going to check on it. We're just going to assume that it's going to be productive. And maybe some people are productive in their Slack conversations all the time. Maybe some people aren't. I remember when I had my first cubicle job, this is crazy, Paul, but someone had made a clone, I think it was actually of Microsoft Excel that you could go to in the browser, and it was basically Facebook that looked like Excel. So it had like chat screens and certain cells and things like that. And that's what I think about it now, and it's kind of dumb, but I used to use that. And now we have Slack, you know, which can be used for being productive, but it also can be a huge time sink.
Yeah, and I mean, Slack and productivity is probably an entirely separate conversation, I guess. But I think for me, I'm just trying to have less notifications. I still spend a lot of time in Slack. I still spend a lot of time in email. I still spend a ton of time communicating. Hell, I still spend a lot of time in Twitter. But I'm trying to make it my choice more and not be pulled in by the constant stream of notifications. I'm trying to make it something that I'm more mindful of when I choose to do those things.
That's a really good way of putting it. You're the one choosing to be affected by the notifications, not the other way around. So I recently also turned off any red dots on my phone, on the home screen of my phone. And it's been amazing because I have that problem where if I see the dot, I got to get rid of it, right? Doesn't matter what I'm doing. I will stop what I'm doing and I'll get rid of that dot. And so now that they're not there, it's just kind of like liberating. Like I check Snapchat when I want to. I check my text messages when I want to and not when there's a number that needs to be cleared out, which has been really useful.
Although I do have to say, I've sent you some snaps that it's taken you a while to watch.
But I still watch them. It's usually when I'm brewing coffee at work.
Yeah, most of your snaps are coffee related.
That's when I'm snapping. Yeah, so I nearly avoided a catastrophe for this episode because it was 11:30 rolled around and I started to get the precursor headache and I realized I had not made coffee. And so I ran downstairs quick and made it. But, you know, the idea that you choose when you are notified or you choose when you check all that stuff is kind of freeing, which is silly to say, right? Because you could throw your phone in the trash can and never look at it again. And that's a choice you have. You can make that choice. We have the technology to dispose of your phone forever. It's called a trash can or a swimming pool or the ocean or your car tire.
And people always approach this problem as if it were that black and white. The only choices are being addicted to your phone or throwing it in the ocean. But that's just not the case. There are so many gray areas in between that. And really, like I said, what I'm trying for right now is I still love all these things. I love Slack. I even kind of love email, at least in some ways. And I love Twitter. I love all these things that can be distractions. But I'm trying to figure out how, for me personally, I can make them less of a distraction and more of a tool that I choose to look at and I choose to use.
The New York Times article I mentioned reads a lot of like, think of the children, think of their, you know, how they're growing up with not being able to focus on anything and having Snapchat be the most important thing or having, you know, whatever device be the most important thing. But I like what you said there about how they're, you know, people are always different. And it's interesting because you can look at mass media. I mean, you have more access to see what people are thinking, like a massive amount of people. It's called Twitter and Facebook, right? Which is something that people didn't have previously. So I feel like today is much easier to make a mass generalization of like, oh, the next generation is a bunch of idiots because of a few tweets that you read that kind of rubbed you the wrong way, you know? But it's always been that way. People said that about books when books started coming around.
After the printing press. I mean, once paperbacks kind of came out, this is late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a moral outrage about the youths having their noses stuffed in books all the time. And it's always that. It's always there's a new thing. There's something that is going to ruin the children. And we need to abolish it. We need to be rid of it. But nothing is that black and white ever, or at least very nearly ever. And so I think it's important to just look at things and look at how they can be useful to you instead of focusing on how they might be detrimental.
Right, exactly. Looking at things and seeing how they might be useful to you, you know, not looking at things on Twitter and everyone else said this is useful, so I'm gonna use it. And now I'm going to tell you have to use it because someone I look up to said that I have to use it. I guess the older that I get, the more that I realize that these choices are my own and I can make any. I can throw my phone out the window right now as you watch me, Paul. I could do that if I wanted to. I just don't. I mean, I guess I have insurance on my phone, so I could. It wouldn't matter anyway. But you know what I'm trying to say.
Definitely. And I think the concept of all these things being such personal choices is so important. Like we talk about personal productivity all the time. And I think people lose the personal part of that. What makes that personal is that one thing that works for you really well may or may not work for me at all, or parts of it might work or parts of it, you know, it could be a 60-40 split. Who knows? There's so many ways for that to play out, but personal productivity really is personal. And I think that's important to remember.
Well, I mean, we're all, to some degree these days, we're all a product of marketing anyway, right? So people will forget that personal productivity is a personal thing because all these apps getting released on Product Hunt to say, this is the best way to organize your time, or this is the best way to knock off your to-do items, or this is the best way to do X, the best way to do Y. So every app that comes out, this is the best and the only way to be doing this thing. And after a while, you hear that and you see that and it just becomes like a saturated thing. You start to lose the idea that you are different and maybe you function differently. I don't know. I mean, again, that's kind of generalized because there's certainly people that don't feel that way, but I certainly feel that way at times. I feel like I have so many things pushed on me that I tend to forget how I actually am. And I know I've mentioned it before, but the book Quiet by Susan Cain was a huge eye-opener for me because I'm definitely an introverted person. And that book talks about introverted people in a very marketing-driven world.
So I feel like all this talk about personal productivity and personal opinions really actually kind of weirdly leads into the second thing I wanted to talk about today. And that is, strangely enough, an article by Roger Ebert called You Give Out Too Many Stars. And in this article, he writes about the fact that he tended to give out higher ratings for movies on average. I believe it was like 12 points higher than the average is what he did. And he kind of talks about some of the reasoning for that. And this sounds like it would have absolutely nothing at all to do with programming. It sounds like something that the last thing that we'd ever be talking about on this podcast, but I think it actually is weirdly relevant. So there are a few things I just really loved about this article. The first one is the San Francisco Chronicle's little man rating system. And basically what this is, instead of using stars, I don't know if they still do this, but at least at one point, the SF Chronicle used a little drawing of a person in a chair. And it was five different chairs and five different people. The first one was an empty chair. So it was literally so bad that the person walked out. The second one, there was a sleeping person. The third one, sitting upright and being very attentive. Fourth, clapping and very excited about the movie. And then the fifth one, literally jumping out of the chair, so excited and clapping and just joyful. And when I looked at this for the first time ever, I had never heard of this. And I looked at this article, I saw these five little drawings and I was like, oh, that makes 10 times more sense than any star rating system I've ever seen in my life.
Well, it gives you more of an emotion tied to that movie as opposed to just a star. Because you can see this person. So I'm looking at these drawings and I see the person, the last one that's super excited. And I don't feel like I've ever been that excited in my entire life. It makes me understand or see that and think about a particular emotion.
Well, the issue with star ratings for me is that I look at a star rating and it's 3 stars. And 3 stars doesn't inherently mean something. 3 stars to me, I look at that and think, oh, 60%, that's a D. I wouldn't want to see a 3-star movie out of 5 stars. That sounds really terrible. But when I see the third little man sitting upright and is happy about watching this movie, I actually know exactly the type of movie that is and what that means. That's a much more tangible thing to me. And even though stars or just point systems are so widespread, what the Chronicle has done with the little man is take that and reevaluate it. It's still 5 things, but each one has a very literal meaning. You know exactly what it means for a movie to be so bad that you walk out of the theater. You know exactly what it means for a movie to be so boring that you fell asleep watching it. But you don't really exactly know what 1 star or 2 stars mean. And so really what the takeaway for me is here is that just because everybody's using stars doesn't mean that that's the right answer. This is a great thing to remember in design or dev as well. Just because everybody's using React doesn't mean that's necessarily the right answer for you. It doesn't mean it's necessarily the wrong answer, but you should remember that if something is very popular, it might be great, or it might be great sometimes, or it might not be great. All of those are completely possible.
And the interesting thing is that all of those are completely possible for all the different people. So you can have as many permutations there because different people have different preferences and feelings and wants for the projects, and what might be 3 stars for you might be 5 stars for me. It's just all personal. And we talked about it a few episodes back, but talking about how it's not really great to criticize what people choose as their tech stacks. And I mean, there's objective views that you can have, like say, you and I were talking about PHP the other night, and I was saying that I was going to jump into it a little bit deeper because, you know, a lot of like Statamic or craft sites that I do, I could be more efficient and I could do more customized things for my clients if I were better at PHP. And we started talking about it and we started talking about how some of the things that PHP does or does out of the box anyway is they're interesting. We'll say that. But that, I mean, what you did not do was like, that's a terrible idea and you should not do that at all altogether. What you did say was, well, it's interesting that PHP does things this way. And that's not how I would choose to do it if I were building it, but that's just how it is.
It's so common to dogpile on languages like PHP or things where everybody just hates it. You know, oh, PHP is the worst. PHP sucks. I would never write PHP. And Roger Ebert actually discusses that exact phenomenon in this article as well. He says, there's a quote, "Once the scent of blood is in the water, the sharks arrive. I like to write as if I'm on an empty sea." It's so common in movies and in programming for something to be labeled as bad or to be labeled as the next amazing thing. And then everybody just kind of follows that. But again, something being the common answer doesn't mean that it's the right one. PHP, in your case, is a very valuable thing to be learning, even in 2016, because the clients that you're working with right now and the tech stacks that they're using involve PHP.
Yeah, certainly. And I really, really liked that point, the point where he says, you know, once the blood's in the water, you know, all the sharks will come. But the point that I like the most is his first point, and he was saying, you know, why do I give more stars on average than other reviewers? And his answer was simply because I like movies. I just enjoy them. So I go into the movie wanting to like it. I don't go into the movie with an attitude of like, well, this is probably going to be terrible. And that will obviously affect the outcome. That will affect the ratings that you give this movie. And so I try to approach all of the programming that I do, all the projects that I work on with, I like programming. I like building stuff. I like handing over the keys to a new site to a client and watching them use it. And if that is done in PHP, then I'm going to try to enjoy it as much as I can. I don't know. That was just my favorite thing. He just enjoys movies. And that's why he gives better ratings on average than other reviewers.
Yeah, exactly. If you like something, you like it. That's just part of who you are. You won't always be into the cool new stuff because everybody has different tastes. Sometimes you will be. Sometimes you'll be a pioneer. But sometimes it's just time to go back and learn PHP a bit more. There's nothing wrong with either one of those things, but being aware of your inherent biases as a person is so important. Knowing that going in, you really like programming and that you really like learning about new technologies, that will color your opinions of things just as much as if you go in being sour about them already.
Yeah, well, I guess it's like being a chef too, or, you know, being someone that needs to cook for a living. You should probably have tried lots of things. And the only thing that will do is give you perspective. You know, I've never really met any chefs that are refusing to eat certain types of foods because they just don't think they'll like it.
I think even if you think you might not like something, you should still try it in most cases. Some of the best things that have ever happened to me are because I tried doing something that I thought I was going to hate. When I was a kid, we talked about this last episode. When I was a kid, I wanted to do IT. I didn't want anything to do with programming. It was just something that I was learning on the side for a bit of fun. I never wanted to be a programmer for a living. But that ended up happening. I never thought I was going to like management. I never thought I was going to like doing as much client work as I've done. And all of those things, just by knowing my biases, knowing what I liked and didn't like, but then trying things anyway, I've learned and grown. And I'm trying to apply that more and more to my programming life as well. Remember to check out spec.fm to learn more about the other shows on the network. I already mentioned Orthogonal, which you should definitely give a listen, but we've got another new one as well. It's called Runtime, and it's hosted by Caleb Davenport and Sam Sofas. They're talking about Swift, iOS, and other things they like. Of course, after you listen to all the new shows, remember to rate them in the iTunes store. That's one of the quickest and most effective ways you can help support us and the rest of the network. Sidebar, I think you might be the only truly introverted person I've ever met, in like the actually pure sense of that word.
Yeah.
Anyhow, and sidebar.
Like a cave troll.